Thank you all for coming. My name is Molly Kleiman. I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy. As you, most of you know, we've been here since the middle of May, and we'll be here in residence at PS1 through August, organizing over 50 programs that are conversations, lectures, performances on the topic of speculations here every day that the museum is open, except for the warm-up Saturdays. Before introducing our wonderful speaker today, I just wanted to give everyone an update about what's happening this weekend. Tomorrow, Karn Ross, who's the founder of The Independent Diplomat, will discuss a future in which political power is redistributed from governments to individuals. On Saturday, artists Alyssa Baraboim, Ian Chang, Josh Klein, and AJ Kurian. And Josh Klein is a curator who did the Pro Bio exhibit downstairs on the second floor. So the group of them will discuss a future of the body, the future of art, and the artist as a speculative thinker, and posthumanism. So it's very much in line with some of the writings by Catherine Hales, our guest today. And on Sunday, Alex Grievich and Kathy Weeks will discuss the role of work in a better future. So hopefully you can join us for some of those events as well. But today we're welcoming Catherine Hales, who's a professor of comparative literature at Duke, and she's the author of How We Became Post-Human, Virtual Bodies in Cybernetics, Literature, and Informatics. She's also the author of Electronic Literature, New Horizons for the Literary, and Writing Machines, which is a study of the printed book in the digital age. She writes with rigor and with humor about the interactions between content and digital environments and the relationships between embodied subjects and computational machines. Earlier this afternoon at 2, she walked us through the first module of an alternative reality game called Speculation, which she developed with the Greater Than Games Lab at Duke, which explored the culture of Wall Street investment banks in the context of the 2008 global economic crisis. But now for her lecture, she'll speak about a future of algorithmic trading and the urgent need for humanists, artists, technologists to offer counter-narratives to the dominant theories of global finance capital. So she'll speak for about 40 minutes, and then there will be time for a Q&A. Thanks.
I'd like to thank Molly for that introduction and also for the invitation to be here today. So I'll be reading a paper with maybe a few extraneous comments thrown in here and there, and I'd be eager to have whatever thoughts or responses or comments you have at the end. One of the dangers haunting our historical present is global financial instability. Working toward a more sustainable future entails coming to terms with finance capital, recognizing our complicity with it, and envisioning better ways to demand accountability, creating better stories to foster social responsibility, and devising better critical methods to narrow the gap between where we are and where we want to be. To explore a specific aspect of how these negotiations are proceeding, I will focus on the complex interconnections between humans, intelligent machines, infrastructure, and capitalism in the context of the global economic system, especially U.S. stock markets. Not all the agents in this story are human. Moreover, the amounts and kinds of human agency is heavily dependent on infrastructural considerations that exceed the ability of any one person to control. At issue is the rapid transformation of the U.S. stock market, as well as other world markets, from a mixed human-machine ecology that obtained prior to 1995 to the machine-machine ecology that prevails today. As digital algorithms increasingly took control of financial transactions, not only did the relation of humans to the global economic system change, but also the system dynamics itself. The result has been a dramatic increase in market fragility and the rise of uncontrollable instabilities that threaten to explode at any millisecond. Consequently, the configurations that define the human have once again been rearranged, so that time and space are now parceled out in novel ways between machines and between intelligent machines and humans. What our response as academics, humanities scholars, and artists should be to these developments, and how we might contribute positively to a future that will contribute to global stability and economic justice, will comprise my conclusion. An example will illustrate the perils of algorithmic trading. Amazon sells books through third parties as well as through its own distributions. One such book, entitled The Making of a Fly, shot up in 10 days from an initial price of $199 to $24 million, to be precise, $23,698,655.93 plus shipping. How did this absurd price emerge? So here we see it in action. So the first seller had an algorithm that priced the book at $1.27 times the price of the second seller. Second seller priced at 0.998 of the first seller. So let's suppose that the second seller has the book at $100. Then the first seller's algorithm prices at $127. Second seller responds to that. First seller responds to that. And within the space of a couple of days, you're up at $23 million plus. And of course, this is only a mistake that an algorithm could have made. Any human would have known immediately this price is ridiculous. When and how did the market revolution happen that moved the action from human traders to automated trading algorithms? Wall Street Journal writer Scott Patterson traces the history of automated trading in his book, Dark Pools. He recounts the origins of automated trading in the programs Josh Levine designed for Daytech, a firm that traded on Instanet, a private exchange created for firms to buy and sell stocks directly to one another, avoiding the steep fees charged by the New York Stock Exchange and the associated Old Boys Network. When Daytech asked for lower fees from Instanet and was turned down, the company went out on its own, and Levine created Island, a new kind of electronic pool in which algorithms, or algos, as Wall Street calls them, with names like Dagger, Sniper, Raider, and Stealth, fought each other using cutting-edge artificial intelligences to buy and sell in reaction times measured in milliseconds. Moreover, Island made available free to all its users a program called Book Viewer, in which all the orders to buy and sell were listed, an invaluable resource that the major exchanges were charging hefty fees for. Levine sent out an email to users of his Watcher program, writing in January 1996, "We want Island to be good and fair and cheap and fast. We care. We are nice. SelectNet is run by NASDAQ. They don't care. InstaNet is run by Reuters. They aren't nice. Won't you join us on Island?" When Levine wrote that InstaNet was not nice, he was referring to the ways in which traders ripped off other traders, and indeed their own clients, helped by exchanges such as InstaNet that cloaked their bids from public view. A trader could, for example, offer to buy a stock for a client while offering to sell the same stock over InstaNet at a higher price. The client wouldn't know about this side deal because he couldn't see the InstaNet side of the offer. In other practices, traders would front-run a stock. For example, if they actually wanted to buy a stock, they would jack up the price, not intending ever to actually buy it to get other traders to go for the higher price. And then, when the price went down, they'd gobble it up at a reduced price, which traders who didn't belong to InstaNet could not see. NASDAQ had its own set of abusive practices. In 1995, the SEC investigated antitrust practices on NASDAQ, partly as a result of statistical research by two college professors, Bill Christie and Paul Schultz. And what they found was that there were many few orders that are priced at odd eighths, that is 1/8, 3/8, 5/8, 7/8, on NASDAQ than would statistically be expected. And they argued persuasively that what the traders were doing was changing the eighths to the next highest fraction, even fraction, 1/4, 1/2, 3/4, and so forth, as a result increasing the spread and the money that they could earn. So in response to this development, the SEC introduced the new order handling rules that created new entities called electronic communication networks, or ECNs, and they imposed certain restrictions on markets such as InstaNet to list their quotes on NASDAQ. Patterson summarizes the effects of the ECNs. With the order handling rules, the entire NASDAQ marketplace would shift toward an electronic platform wide open to computer-driven trading. The phone-based system of human dealers would quickly become a screen-based cyberpunk network of computer jockeys born and bred in electronic pools such as Island. With the floodgates open to computerized trading, speed became the name of the game. Stock trading companies pay high fees to have their computers located on rack space within the server farms run by the major exchanges, a process called co-location, because the proximity shaves milliseconds off the time it takes to transfer the information. And they can therefore take advantage of the small price difference that occurs in that time. Currently, an ultra-fast transatlantic cable is being constructed at the cost of several billion dollars to connect high-frequency traders in the U.S. with those in Britain. The estimated acceleration is 5 milliseconds, which works out to about $1 billion per millisecond advantage. So that gives you some idea of the potential profits. High-frequency traders using sophisticated algorithms operating at micro-temporalities inaccessible to humans make thousands of trades in a day, adopting a policy never to hold a stock overnight. As a result, the average time a stock has held has plummeted across all the exchanges. So after World War II, it was about 4 years. In the year 2000, that had dropped to 8 months. In 2012, it's currently 22 seconds. The amount of information exchanged on the stock trades correspondingly grew to gargantuan figures. Nanex, a high-tech firm that tracks speed trading, estimates that on all U.S. stocks, options, futures, and index on a single day, 1 trillion bytes of data are exchanged. As speed trading increased, the duopoly of the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ shattered into a number of private markets, such as InstaNet, as well as dark pools, trading sites where quotes are hidden from public view. Attempting to cope with this fragmentation, the SEC introduced in 2007 a new set of regulations called the National Market System, or Reg NMS. The idea was to bind together all the electronic marketplaces into a single network so they could operate as a true national market. At the heart of the Reg NMS was the mandate that any order to buy or sell a stock must be routed to the market that had the best price. If there was a disparity, for example, between a stock sold on NASDAQ and a higher price listed on New York Stock Exchange, the order would, sell order would automatically be routed to the New York Stock Exchange. So what happened then is a variety of ways emerged using these algorithms to game the system. So one way this is done is by orders that sit at the front of the queue. So orders are executed in the queue according to the time that they were placed. And these orders repress the orders further back. But not only that, the exchanges, in order to encourage market makers to provide liquidity, started offering maker and taker fees. So companies that drained liquidity from the market had to pay the maker fees or the taker fees. Companies that provided liquidity were given a small rebate or a maker fee. So in addition to fooling around with the orders in which the orders were executed, the algorithms found a way to make other algorithms take the fees while they got the rebate. And even though these were small amounts, if you add them up, how many milliseconds there are in a trading day, these maker and taker fees soon amounted to more than you were making on the stock sale or stock purchase in itself. This situation makes clear the emergence of a new type of hypercapitalism that I'll call vampiric capitalism, for it preys on other capitalist entities. When Karl Marx characterized capital as a vampire, in Capital One, he dramatized it as feeding upon the bodies of workers. As Franco Moretti has pointed out in his influential essay about Marx's use of the vampire figure, the vampire is also appropriate because Marx defined capital as dead labor, or using the vampire metaphor, we might call it undead labor. Moreover, like a vampire whose thirst for blood is never abated, no matter how much he devours, capital continuously seeks new markets and more profits. Unrestrained by child labor laws, workplace safety regulations, limitations on the hours laborers worked, and so forth, capitalism as Marx knew it was beholden only to the profit motive. Vampiric capitalism differs from Marx's vampire capitalism because it feeds not on the body of workers, but on other capitalist entities. Like Marx's vampire, however, vampiric capitalism in the present is also stripped of everything but the profit motive. While workers suffered under vampire capitalism, the entire global economic system suffers under vampiric capitalism. In this sense, hypercapitalism exceeds in its scope and potential devastation even the horrific abuses that Marx saw in his day. If the global economic system crashes, we will all be affected. Infested with vampiric capitalism, the stock market has drifted far from its initial purposes. And what are those purposes? The legitimate purposes of finance capital? To provide capital in the form of IPOs for new corporations that are forming, to provide a way for ordinary people to invest disposable income in the stock market, and so forth. But high-frequency traders, the object of my critique here, perform neither of these useful services. They justify their existence by claiming they provide liquidity for the marketplace, and they have also driven down the spread between buy and sell orders, which they argue benefits everyone. But as we shall see, there's another side to this story. Although their commissions are smaller, because they trade so often, the pennies quickly mount to dollars and eventually into billions in profits a year, money that ultimately comes out of the pockets of investors. The deleterious effect on innovation can be seen in the alarming decrease in publicly traded companies. In 1997, there were 8,200 public companies. By 2010, only 4,000 remained. The most disastrous effects, however, are the instabilities that high-frequency trading introduces into the marketplace. For example, Nanex, the company that analyzes the algorithms high-frequency traders use, detected an algorithm it called the disruptor. The disruptor is designed to flood the market with so many orders that effectively it disrupts the market itself. These instabilities became shockingly evident on April 6, 2010, when in the space of 2 minutes, the Dow fell 700 points and then just as quickly recovered. How did this happen? In an already down market, nervous about possible defaults by Greece and Spain, Waddle and Reed Financial in Kansas City was monitoring a massive order to sell 75,000 S&P 500 E-mini futures contracts worth about $4 billion. The algorithm they were using was designed to sell at a pace that would keep it about 9% of the market's overall volume, with 30-second pauses to throw off shark algorithms hunting for whales or large orders, so they could front-run them or otherwise profit from detecting the sell order. These sell orders were bought by high-frequency funds that within milliseconds, sold them again to other high-frequency traders at slightly lower prices, and those algorithms sold them again. As the volume shot up and the market plunged down, the trading algorithm from Waddell and Reed sold more and more because its 9% limit kept increasing, which prompted an even fiercer feedback cycle. Patterson reports that, quote, within a 14-second period, high-frequency traders bought and sold an astonishing 27,000 of these contracts. As the market plunged, other stocks were affected as well. Accenture, a global consulting company that normally sells for about $50 a share, dropped to the absurd price of a penny a share. And this probably is a so-called stub quote. So market makers are required to put in quotes for various stocks, and they put in quotes they never expect to have filled, like a penny a share. But during this short period of 6 minutes, Accenture actually dropped to a penny a share and was bought up by these orders. Procter & Gamble plunged from its normal price of $60 a share to around $30. On the other end of the scale, some stocks, notably Apple, demonstrated an amazing upward spike, with Apple reaching $10,000 a share, which is probably another stub quote. As the insanity proceeded, many high-frequency traders, alarmed by the volatility and concerned that transactions would be retroactively canceled, simply pulled the plugs on their computers. And I mean, they literally pulled them out from the wall. This meant that even fewer buyers were in the market, accelerating the market's downward plunge. Only when the New York Stock Exchange shut down trading for 5 seconds was the feedback cycle broken, and at that point, because prices on many stocks were ridiculously low, the algorithm started buying, and within a couple of minutes, the market was back to where it was before, but not before inflicting real harm on many buyers. One unfortunate person was trying to sell Procter & Gamble during this interview, and he lost $17,000, and a hedge fund in Dallas lost several million dollars when the price of the options it was buying spiked from 90 cents to $30 a contract. Subsequently, the SEC revoked or broke trades that exceeded a 60% variation on their price before the flash crash. Then the SEC sent about to investigate what caused the flash crash. And finally, they issued a report 5 months later. So notice that the flash crash lasted 6 minutes. It took the SEC 5 months to issue a report. And when they issued their report, they identified this large sell order from Waddell and Reed as the culprit. Mark Buchanan, a theoretical physicist who blogs on financial matters, references the research done by Eric Scott Hunsader, founder of Nanex and a software engineer. Hunsader followed 6,483 trades that Waddell and Reed made on that fateful day. Buchanan notes, quote, the company's execution broker fed the market throughout the day, a tactic specifically designed to minimize the price impact of a large sale. Instead of locating the problem in this sale, Hunsader's analysis, quote, suggests this plunge was caused by high-frequency traders. They typically act as liquidity providers, standing ready to buy and sell at certain price levels. But the day's volatility prompted them to dump their holdings to avoid losses. It was this selling, not Waddell and Reed's passive orders, that caused the liquidity to disappear. The comments to Buchanan's blog post are revealing, and these are sign-in names, so they sound strange. Guest called the SEC report a fairy tale. And Fritz commented that, quote, it's about time somebody pointed out might making trades is not the equivalent to providing liquidity. The exchanges have hoodwinked the regulators into believing that it's acceptable to pay brokers for making trades. The farce is that the exchanges call this providing liquidity. Regulators need to wake up to the fact that sales which trigger due to a price decrease are removing liquidity rather than providing it. Sofa Call commented, this is why I've been out of the market for the past 6 years. It's no longer possible to handicap value. all you can try to do is catch the trend, which is not that much different from casino gambling. Only the gambling commissions do a better job of assuring that the casinos are honest than the SEC does with the financial markets. Calling the SEC report, quote, a trend in finance capital public relations strategy, Matthew noted that most people, quote, won't understand they're being ripped off if the con is cloaked in a modest level of complexity, unquote. H.H. Holmes succinctly summed up the consensus. The facade that the industry has anything to do with people investing in business is gone. All algorithms, all the time. Joe Sixpack meets Skynet. The significance of the flash crash was underscored by Nanex's research into other many flash crashes that occurred from 2006 to 2010, but went largely unnoticed because they involved single stocks and unfolded too quickly to attract attention. Flash crashes tend to disappear in statistics using day-by-day figures. A finer-grained temporal metric, such as one used by Nanex, is necessary to spot them. Their analysis found 254 such mini crashes in 2006 before Reg NMS was initiated, and in 2007, when it was being rolled out, the number jumped to over 2,000. In 2008, when Reg NMS was fully in effect, that number increased to 4,065. So this is a graph on the top showing how many flash crashes occurred in this time. The graph on the bottom is the same data, but mapped to a logarithmic scale. Neil Johnson, a physicist at the University of Miami, published with his colleagues an article entitled Financial Black Swans Driven by Ultrafast Machine Ecology that confirmed Nanex's research. So black swan may be a term you're familiar with. It's the title of Nassim Taleb's very influential book. And the title refers to the idea that when you say swan, you naturally think of a white swan. So a black swan is an anomaly, a very unusual phenomenon. And the argument of Taleb's book is that, in fact, black swan events are much, much more common than we ordinarily think because we're focused on the ones that fulfill our expectation. And I've been getting some tutoring in the Black-Scholes equation and in the Gaussian copula formula that's used by financial traders to price derivatives. And indeed, the expectation of equilibrium status is deeply built into those equations. That means when you get a situation far out of equilibrium, then the equations don't work. They go crazy. And consequently, this research on how frequent flash crashes in fact are has implications way beyond the flash crash itself. What it implies is that systemic instabilities are being introduced into the global financial market in a way that the everyday equations that every trader relies on to price their products don't work. So that's a kind of astonishing result suggesting that financial instability is now not an anomaly, it's becoming systemic. And it relies on the fact that these equations, in fact, all presume an equilibrium situation. So in effect then, what the flash crash of 2010 meant is not that the Waddell and Reed sell order initiated the flash crash. The flash crash was caused by the systemic dynamics. And the Waddell and Reed order was the last straw that initiated it, its breaking. But the fact that it would break sooner or later was already implicit there in the way that the system was operating. The anxieties such a situation can unleash are palpable, especially when we realize that almost everyone on the planet is likely to be affected by these systemic risks to the global financial system posed by the ultra-fast ecology of dueling algorithms. There is, in a nutshell, no way out of the global interconnected system. And I should mention that I got interested in this topic of finance capital because in the financial meltdown of 2008, I lost in the space of a couple of weeks about a third of my life savings. That was a big wake-up call for me that I needed to pay much more attention to this, and I needed to understand this system much better than I did, and that's when I began my research into it. And the more research I did, the more frightened I began. So I spent a few weeks trying to imagine how I could opt out of this system. And short of stuffing cash in your mattress, there isn't any way to opt out. And in fact, even if you stash cash in your mattress, you still haven't opted out because the value of that cash is totally dependent on the entire economic system. So I'm going to make the claim in a minute that everyone in this room is, one way or another, deeply implicated in finance capital. If you have personal investments, you're implicated. If you have retirement funds, you're implicated. If you are associated with a museum or a university, you're implicated because the endowments of those institutions are heavily dependent on finance capital. And I dare say there's no one in this room who isn't implicated in one way or another. So the implication of this is that we can't afford to point a finger of blame at the finance capital industry and adopt a holier-than-thou attitude, because if we think about this honestly, we have to realize that we're all implicated in this system. But by that same reasoning, the fact that we're implicated means that we have a stake in it and means that we have the right to help contest for how it operates and what its master narratives are. So let me just quickly skip now to one of the theorists, one of the few humanists who's actively engaged with this problem. And this is a theorist that was mentioned in the earlier session, Bernard Stiegler. In a large sense, as Stiegler points out, the situation is not a technological problem, but one of value and meaning. We may note here an echo of Heidegger's famous argument that the essence of technology is nothing technological. Through a series of important texts, Technics and Time 1, 2, and 3, Taking Care, and especially his recent For a New Critique of Political Economy, he undertakes the ambitious project of proposing a general framework through which to understand the coevolution of humans and techniques. Because of its scope, the project has both impressive virtues and limitations that may not be immediately apparent. The test case proposed here, automated trading, may help to refine Stiegler's framework and also reveal new insights as to where the coevolution between humans and techniques is heading in the contemporary period. In Technics 1 and 2, Stiegler develops the concept of tertiary retention, memory stored in artifacts that allow access to events a person never experienced firsthand. Moreover, he argues that tertiary retention precedes individual cognition because, for example, a book precedes the birth of a baby who reads it in adulthood. In Taking Care, this formulation is linked with the development of long circuits that allow transindividuation to occur, resulting in an individual becoming intellectually mature and taking responsibility. Subverting the development of long circuits are what Stiegler calls the programming industries, such as television, video games, and the web, which seek to capture the attention of young people and convert the tradition of what I've called deep attention into hyperattention. The case of automated trading programs allows us to see in Stiegler's concept of tertiary retention an implicit and unrecognized print-centric bias. While tertiary retention works well for manuscripts and books as external storage device, it covers over the rupture that occurred when techniques ceased to be about storage and instead became about machine agency and systemic machine ecologies. So a book, for example, can be said to possess agency when someone opens it, reads it, and their mindset is changed by that book. But the book itself does not possess agency. And it's converted from a passive possibility into an actuality only because a human's involved in the process of reading and writing. The whole point of automated trading programs is that once created and set in motion, they don't require any human agency to act. Indeed, the whole point is to cut humans out of the circuit so that they can operate at these micro-temporalities of milliseconds. Stiegler is correct in noting that the creation of a grammatological process such as alphabetization breaks a continuous flow of words into discrete units such as letters, phonemes, etc. However, using this same term for digitization glosses over the difference between the alphabet and executable program code. While letters are passive, codes executed by a machine that can actually make things happen without human intervention. Long circuits, as Stiegler uses them, applies to human cognition, but machines have long circuits too, so this is just a diagram of a typical execution order, and you can see how roundabout it can become. It also could be a diagram for machinic anticipation. Anticipation becomes a machine function as algorithms search for patterns that will enable them to predict micro movements of stock prices, as well as orders that competing algorithms are about to execute. In a sense, these algorithms have both too much memory, hypernesia, as they race through real-time data streams, and too little memory, hyponesia, as they jettison the information about what happened yesterday to cope with the huge amounts of information streaming into their processing units. And I'll just make a point here that in these computers, there are no unused computer cycles. That is, there is no point at which the machine is simply resting, unlike humans that have to sleep sometime during the day or the night. These machines never sleep, they never rest. And when the staff goes home, which happens very late for investment bankers, they're still cycling through their program, still anticipating stock prices, still placing bids that will be executed as soon as the exchange is open. The issue is not memory alone, then, but a transformation of global economic systems that increasingly drive us toward vampiric capitalism and away from social responsibility. So to get a sense of how much finance capital is now affecting our culture, it's estimated that about 40% of all financial trades occur through these trading algorithms. That's a huge percentage. And that means that that is exerting a pressure on many cultural concepts, such things as how we think about the future, how we think about anticipation, how we think about the role of humans in relation to these automated programs. So now we come to the crucial question. How can we recover a sense of the future that contributes positively to economic justice and pulls us away from the increasingly precarious position into which these developments are leading? So right here and now, I'll make a prediction. A year from now or 10 years from now, you can check back and see if this prediction has come true. I predict that the financial crisis of 2008 was what Giovanni Arrighi calls a signal crisis. It was the forerunner of the major crisis. The major crisis is coming. It might come next year, it might come 2 years from now, but I will stake my claim on saying that sooner or later it will come, and it will be of a magnitude that will wreak economic havoc with the entire globe. Yes, the U.S. is one of the centers, global centers of finance capital. That will certainly happen. It will involve everyone, whether you're a capitalist or a worker or even unemployed, the same way the 2008 crisis did. But it will be much deeper, it will be much longer, and it will be much more serious. So if you're like me and you're not that far away from your retirement and you're thinking about where can I possibly put this money where it's not going to be affected, I don't have an answer to that. The only answer I have is I'm really frightened. I'm frightened about my future. I'm frightened about the future of the country, I'm frightened about your future. So for me, the question, what can we do to help this situation, is an urgent and pressing one. So you recall that I said Stigler made a crucial contribution by insisting that the problem really is one of value and meaning. Humanities scholars and artists are unlikely to be able to contribute to the debate about regulation. I think regulation is crucially important, but it's apparent from regulation in MS that these regulations are operating in a very complex ecology, and they can create unintended consequences that have deleterious effects. But where we can intervene, I think, is in the narratives that are now underwriting the dominance of Wall Street, and particularly of finance capital. So let me give you a particular example, a specific example. Right now in business schools, the ideology of shareholder value, which you may have heard on the media, is unquestioned. It's taught to business students as the unquestionable dogma that the only body that a corporation is beholden to are its shareholders. But that's a relatively recent historical trend. Prior to 1950, instead of the shareholder value corporation, there was something called the social corporation. And the social corporation differed from the shareholder value corporation because the social corporation recognized multiple stakeholders. They recognized as stakeholders the workers, the management, and also the community. And so what's happening in the present is investment banks are disciplining corporations worldwide the same way they discipline their own workers who are regarded as completely fungible. And the way that they do this is to look for corporations whose assets are more than the value of their stock. Now, you would think a well-run corporation would have assets greater than the value of its stock. That's the safety cushion of the corporation. But as Susan Faludi shows in the takeover of Safeway by a series of investment banks in the late 1990s, that what happens is the raiders see this corporation got all these extra assets. They buy the corporation, they take it private, they sell off the assets, they strip the corporation and weaken it, they make multiple millions in the process, then they put the corporation back on the market. And they do all this under the banner of making U.S. corporations slimmer and meaner. But that's nonsense. They haven't made them slimmer and meaner. They've only weakened them and drained off a huge amount of money from the corporate assets into their own pockets. So they've enfeebled the corporation. They've laid off, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers. They cut back management. Why? Not to achieve greater efficiency, but simply because all those things can be sold, result in excess profits, and they collect the profits. So if you ask, why is the disparity between lower income, middle income people, why is that gap between the upper income people now wider than it's ever been in the last 70 years? A large answer of that is finance capital. And a large answer of that finance capital is in exactly these kinds of tactics. So how can you combat something like that? Well, you might introduce some regulation, but you might also start telling different stories, such as Susan Faludi told with the takeover of Safeway, where you're advocating for a shift from the shareholder value ideology to the social responsibility ideology. That's one way that intervention can be practiced. Another way, which we discussed in the 2 p.m. session with Molly, is this computer game speculation that I and my colleagues made to increase financial literacy. So for me, it's not an idle project to increase financial literacy. It's an absolute necessity. Recently, the PMLA had a special issue on finance capital, and I was very encouraged to see humanities scholars moving into that area. And I'll conclude with just a brief list of, if you're interested in learning more about this field that hardly has a name yet, but what we might call it critical studies in finance capital, here's a way to begin. A list of books that are readily available. Of course, there's many more than these, but these cover a lot of the history and cultural impact of finance capital as it developed from the 16th century to the present. So all of these are great books that I'd highly recommend. And I can give you more suggestions if you'd like. Thank you.
Thanks. So we'll have time for a few questions. I thought maybe I'd start off with a couple. So building directly off of your last comment, I'm wondering about the social corporation, as you described, the management, the community, all these other stakeholders. How is there a way, do you see, or are there strategies that you see for translating these other stories, other narratives, injecting them into, do you see them being injected into the algorithm or into the systems of trade, or does that algorithmic trading have to be dismantled completely?
Well, what I am imagining here is that right now a lot of these narratives are going uncontested in our culture. We're at a very neoliberal moment in our political situation in this country where free market capitalism reigns as an almost unquestioned good, despite the fact that many people are still criticizing it. But if you look at what's actually happening in the financial markets, it's dominant. So I think that regulation can help. For example, regulation about how takeovers are executed and what kinds of takeovers are permitted. But really what we need is a whole sea change in popular sentiment. And we hear so much about how Wall Street is helping U.S. corporations and Wall Street is helping the economy as a whole, and the public forgets quickly. So in the wake of 2008, Wall Street came in for a good amount of criticism. But now that the market has rebounded, that criticism appears muted, and people are sort of back to normal and accepting our present situation as that's the way business is done. But the one thing I didn't mention about the shareholder value ideology is that it disciplines corporations, even corporations who may want to follow a different model, to be so concerned with their current stock price, it only goes to the next quarterly report, if that. That means that U.S. corporations and corporations globally are operating on extremely short-range vision. And as a consequence, a lot of business decisions, which are not sound business in the long run, are taken simply to prop up the share price. And the ultimate example of that would be Enron. So Enron crashes because it's unsustainable. Its workers lose their retirement funds, people lose their jobs, it roils the stock market. That's the kind of thing that is the direct result of finance capital. So how do we persuade the public that this is not a good way to operate? And I'll just make a note here that I'm not necessarily arguing against capitalism per se. I'm arguing against finance capitalism. Let us say you believe wholeheartedly in capitalism. You think capitalism is the greatest economic system the world has ever invented. Then you should be against finance capital, because finance capital is bad for capitalism. Of course, if you are not in favor of capitalism, you should also be against finance capital. But either way, finance capital is doing nobody any good except the people who are directly benefiting from these tactics. So, does that message matter? Does it matter that people know this? Does it matter that people know the kind of data behind constructing a new narrative? And I would say, yes, it does matter. We've been sold a bill of goods as a country, mm-hmm. and we need to fight back.
In your suggestions for how we begin to fight back, this discussion of developing counter-narratives, and that it should be the task, or it can be the task, of humanists, of artists, of people in this room, for example. I want to maybe harken back to the conversation we had at 2 p.m. when you discussed the speculation game as a way of, you know, teaching both financial literacy, but also sort of training people to be more cognizant of documents and of theories that they should be upset about. And one term that you've written, that you've used to describe that type of project, is derivative worlding. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about that and the role of derivative worlding in perhaps speculative fiction, other gaming strategies.
Sure. Well, at the heart of finance capital is the whole market in derivatives. And you may know that the market in over-the-counter derivatives has grown exponentially since the late 1990s, and it's now estimated to be greater than the GNP of the entire globe. So the market in derivatives is huge. If you want to find a place to start learning about finance capital, the derivative market is the place to start. And hence derivative worlding. We have material in the game about derivatives and how derivatives function. But what we discovered in the course of making the game was that we were actually engaging in a kind of give and take with our players, because we were creating the game only one step ahead of the players, and the players were in part determining the direction that the game took. And so the derivative worlding is a phrase that's meant to imply two things. One is that derivatives are creating for us a finance capital worldview. They are affecting how we think about the future. They are commodifying the future. They are changing what the future means in a literal sense. But derivative worlding also implies the dynamic within the game where our fiction making and game making was involved in this recursive interplay with the players. So it was derivative in that sense, that it was derivative of their interactions, their interests, and so forth. And the game itself is a form of worlding in the sense any fiction is. It's creating a fictional world that is hoping and trying to interest people in creating a better economic system.
Thanks. I'm going to open it up to those here. If anyone wants to ask a question, please come and speak into the mic, because that it is everything's being live streamed, and it's also for the archive. So thanks.
Yes. I was gonna ask you about in your previous work, you've related financial speculation to speculative realism as a kind of philosophy, particularly the celebration of anti-humanism and the removal of human from the process, which you actually kind of mentioned here. So I brought it up, so maybe you can maybe address that a little bit and speak to it. Thank you.
So I don't know if folks in the audience are familiar with that philosophical movement called speculative realism. It's a relatively new philosophical movement which tries to leave behind an anthropomorphic viewpoint and think about philosophical matters from a non-anthropomorphic perspective to the extent that's possible. So it's rather an involved philosophical movement. We won't have time to go into it all, but one of the proponents of that movement, a philosopher named Graham Harman, proposes that the world is composed of objects and only of objects, and that the interior of objects is unknown and inaccessible. And what interests me about Harman's philosophy is the way that it has much in common with finance capital. On the other hand, it's been adopted by ecological thinkers like Timothy Morton because they like the non-anthropomorphic perspective of the philosophy. So in the work this gentleman was alluding to, I propose that speculative realism is what I call a cultural transducer, a mechanism to bring two apparently absolutely opposed philosophical positions, both participating in the same movement. So you have ecologists who are adopting speculative realism. At the same time, there are many homologies between speculative realism and speculative finance, its obscurity, the emptying out of objects of any real content, which you could say is what derivatives do, and so forth. And so I'm arguing, in effect, that the cultural interest in speculative realism is implicitly a response to the two great fears haunting our cultural moment, and those are global financial collapse and global ecological collapse. And in this fraught moment, when both of these seem all too plausible, then you need something to somehow bring them into harmony, or at least into common ground. That's the role that I was arguing speculative realism occupies. But maybe that's a little technical discussion. I'd be welcome any other questions. Yes.
In the July issue of Harper's, where they have, you know, the list of statistics, which is a beautiful place to get statistics without context, they list the number of publicly traded companies at which directors lost shareholder elections in the past 3 years as 175, and the number of those directors who subsequently stepped down as 9. Do you think that high-frequency trading and the associated stakes have kind of leapt past the ability for human control, or do you think we can still rein it in?
Well, that's a good example of shareholder value in action, I guess you could say, right? But the reality is that shareholders do not participate in the day-to-day workings of the corporation. If you're interested, you might go to the annual shareholder meeting. I myself own a number of shares in companies, only one share, because one share is all I need to own in order to go to the shareholder meetings, and I'm sure it drives them crazy to send out all the materials. I'm sure I cost them at least $20 a year just by holding this one share. But in any event, the ideology of shareholder value usually harkens back in one way or another to Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations. But if you actually read Adam Smith, what you find out is that he was not talking about multinational corporations. He was talking about owner-owned businesses of maybe a dozen people or so. And his argument that these businesses were making for the best possible world for everyone was based on the presumption that the owner of the business was actually managing it on a day-to-day basis. Nothing could be further from the truth with shareholder value. Shareholders do not manage the business on a day-to-day basis. Who manages the corporation on a day-to-day basis? Well, of course, it's the management, but the management is always looking over its shoulder at corporate raiders. So ultimately, it's the finance capitalists who are disciplining the corporations in their day-to-day decisions. So can shareholders actually take over a corporation? I think it's hopeless. I don't think shareholders can ever take over a corporation. I think that's the red herring here. I don't think we should try to get more power to shareholders, though I'm not opposed to that. I think we should change the whole ideology of a shareholder value corporation.
Thank you for such a wonderful lecture, and I wonder if any parallels between global financial capital and current global art world came to your attention, such as, for example, APT, Artist Pension Trust, there is such an organization, but perhaps you could speak about it in the more general terms.
Well, actually, I would be delighted to know more about this. And if you would like to speak about it, please enlighten us all, including me.
Historian and curator, so I'm not equipped to speak about it in professional terms, but I've been researching this organization called Artist Pension Trust, or APT. It's online. Everyone can check it out, and one of the wonderful artists, Walid Raad, also did huge research that was presented at a Documenta this past summer into the workings and so on. But it seems to be based on mutual trust. And they say in relation to what you mentioned, that speed is increasing in the art market. So they say that artists would sell well for 4 years, as opposed to what we knew as decades or centuries, perhaps.
Boy, is that scary, huh? So you have a lifetime of 4 years, and then your market will, personal market will plunge. Yeah. Thank you for that information. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
When you were talking about how we are basically all implicated and there's more or less no escape from financial capital, what was brought to mind was the work of Gibson Graham on a post-capitalist politics and how they take pains to point out the vast number of transactions, different types of economic activities that are non-capitalist, that pervade our lives, and sort of propose a sort of effective politics which attempts to revalorize all that which is actually already around us. So a sort of optimistic or hopeful picture. I'm just wondering if you're not at all as sanguine as they are about the possibilities for that kind of discursive prescriptive.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. And I think this is a point that David Graeber also makes in his book, 5,000 Years of Debt. And Graeber is at pains to point out, as an anthropologist, the fallacy of the usual story we're told. First, there was barter. Barter's very inconvenient, so now you have money. And the reason he wants to resist that is that it makes money inevitable. Money is essential and money is inevitable. But he points out that, in fact, barter economies almost inevitably arise after money has been introduced. Barter isn't the precursor. Barter comes when a currency collapses, like Zimbabwe, for example, or something like that. And so it does suggest exactly what you are pointing out here, that many of our transactions of an economic basis, economic function, do not occur in the realm of capital. They occur in the realm of gifts, of reciprocity. Graeber tells an interesting anecdote about an African tribe that functions primarily on a gift economy, and he says that women will walk, 4 or 5 miles to return the egg that they borrowed from their neighbor the week before, but they always leave a little remainder. So they return the egg, but in addition to the egg, they take a cup of flour. And that's because if exact reciprocity was achieved, then you wouldn't need continuing exchanges. But you always leave a little bit short or a little bit long, because now that fuels the next cycle of reciprocal giving. And I think that if we think about many of our everyday contemporary practices, we could find similar examples. For example, in academia, you're continually asked to do peer review of articles, to do reviews of people coming up for tenure or promotion, and those are all done pro bono. So you give of your time, you make this arrangement, and you sort of expect that somehow in the scope of the universe, good things will flow your way as well. Although I think I'm way on the plus side and don't have enough of the other side coming in. But anyway, that's what happens when you get to be a senior person. But I do agree. I think these non-capitalist exchanges are, in fact, crucial for the functioning of society. And even if they're capitalist exchanges, they rely to an unrecognized extent on trust. And if trust disappears, then the whole economic system is in real trouble. So I thank you. Thank you for that comment. And maybe with that, we should... One last question, okay.
I have no degrees in advanced degrees in technology or AI or business, but I've been looking at the way things have been going as a science fiction reader. We used to be afraid of, you know, artificial intelligence, machines taking over the world, making humans obsolete. I have a theory. I think corporations, the way they stand today, are a form of artificial intelligence. You can get rid of the directors, you can get rid of the board members, you can get rid of the CEO, but the corporation remains. I wonder, what, as a professional, someone who's studied these areas, what is your thought? Any comments you might have on that?
Well, I have a book to suggest. It's by Robert Harris, and it's called The Fear Index. And Robert Harris imagines a corporation, a investment bank, which is powered by an artificial intelligence, but it's an artificial intelligence of the future, which is to say that it can grow and learn. And it does grow and learn, and eventually, this is a spoiler, it begins placing short bets, that is, bets that the market is going to go down, on a whole variety of stocks. And kind of the kicker of the book is that it's not anticipating the market, it's creating the market. And the market does crash, it makes billions of dollars, but in the process it's caused irreparable financial harm to any number of people. So that's a literalization of your scenario where an AI has actually taken control over the company, and when they try to dismantle it, its creator becomes so spooked that he goes to the server farm and burns down the server farm. They find that the AI has now disseminated worldwide through the network and it can't be killed any longer. So if you like Pulp Fiction, I recommend it, The Fear Index by Robert Harris. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.